Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. You may have heard of the Alliance Defending Freedom, or the ADF. It's a Christian legal advocacy group that works to expand Christian culture in society and government. Ryan Christopher is a founding member of the London office and well-known Catholic advocate for the Christian worldview in the political arena. In a previous podcast, he and I discussed the extent to which the culture wars presented, both initially masked and then in a more developed form, a direct challenge to Christian ethics and worldview, in particular by certain ideological strategies, marginalising marriage and the family, downgrading freedom of speech and conscience, and a strategy of desacralising the individual. One of the observations that Ryan made, which emerged from his engagement with political activism, was the effectiveness in which substantial changes to legislation that promoted progressive cultural values, undesired and unwanted by the majority of the population and even the government, were achieved by a very small number of people working within highly focused pressure groups. If this is true, and it is, it presents those of us who don't welcome either the values or the legislation, and it presents the church itself with a need to revisit the way in which we engage with the secular political process. Previous patterns of engagement or disengagement and the reasons for them no longer apply. What should the church be doing in this new febrile culture where democracy and representative government are being so successfully subverted by groups that have such a focused anti-Christian and anti-Catholic agenda? Well, to discuss this further, Ryan Christopher joins me now.
Ryan Christopher, great to have you here again. Our last conversation was great fun. Thank you very much for making yourself available. You're enormously busy. Just to tell me, before we begin, how is ADF this morning?
All is well in the world of ADF. Thanks, Gavin. And for those that don't know us or didn't hear the last podcast, that stands for Alliance Defending Freedom.
So another 30 seconds to give yourself a free advertising to people who've worked.
So ADF, we protect your right to live out and speak your faith, in essence. We do that through the levers and the means by which culture changes, very pertinent to our conversation today. So through litigation, protecting you in court, through advocating to change the law or to have better laws or laws enforced better, but also to train future leaders for the institutions that shape law and culture. So all of which is designed to, as comprehensively as possible, protect your ability to live out and speak the truth.
I've noticed that I'm apocalyptically slightly hypersensitive, and therefore I don't trust my reactions. I question very carefully, but to my great astonishment, in the last 10 years, and even more so the last five, my apocalyptic hypersensitivity seems to be lagging behind the speed with which culture has been changing. In a way that has animosity towards faith. I have to shake myself sometimes and say, is this really happening? Am I sure I haven't conjured this to my fevered imagination? But I really haven't. And I'm seriously taken aback at the level of the animosity that's begun to appear, not just in terms of popular culture, but also being framed in terms of legislation. In our last conversation, you said something that intrigued me and I thought I would want to hear more of, and I think our listeners will too, and that is that you were surprised, or if not surprised, you had noticed that many of the cultural changes have been driven by relatively small interest groups, people who had set up to achieve some political change, and the people who were involved in that change were disproportionately small to the change they'd achieved, or even the people they represented. I suppose one obvious example would be Stonewall. I mean, if it's biologically the case that 1.8% of the population, according to the National Office of Statistics, before it became more culturally attractive and people became mimetic, 1.8% could be expected to be homosexual. Well, increase it, I mean, double it, and you take it to sort of nearly 4%. It's still very small. When you look at the effect that the legislation that Stonewall has imposed upon us, it's wholly and utterly disproportionate. Is this the point at which you were starting your observation? There are obviously other groups doing the same thing. Do you want to talk us through how that's achieved and what that means politically and in terms of our value system?
Yeah, 100%. I think as someone that didn't work in the world of Westminster, I thought that, you know, when you see a piece of legislation, it must be that the will of the people elected a government that had it in their manifesto and the parties behind it, and CCHQ, in the case of a Conservative government, would be planning for this new law and cultural change. And that's how we get the laws we get. And there's this great wave of consent, if you like, and all sorts of elements of process of legitimacy for that great law or cultural change that comes from regulation sometimes. And sometimes that's true, right? I mean, sometimes the system does work that way, but often, and increasingly so, I think it doesn't work that way. And there are all sorts of reasons for that, which include the civil service having a lot more power than I think people would realize in terms of policy making, actually. But it is often very small numbers of people that are changing things very dramatically in our culture. And you point to Stonewall, and I think, you know, a kind of Venn diagram of the Stonewall movement, if you like, along with a very small number of humanists, frankly, very, very small number of active humanists in this country, have had an awful lot of impact over the last few years. And it's changing the culture that Catholics, and particularly our children, will experience. The new relationships and sex education regulations will be one a really clear example of that. It's going to completely reshape how our children learn and the culture that they think is normative, even in Catholic schools, not just in non-Catholic schools. And there was a real moment of understanding that these big cultural changes can happen through very small numbers of people. When I was reading an article by James Kirkup, and it was about 4 years ago, he was political editor at the Times, I think. He was a Spectator contributor, and he wrote this article in Spectator about a document. And it was a document that planned for cultural and legal change on the issue of gender recognition, GRA, in effect. And his remark at the end of his article, as someone that's been involved in Westminster for a long time, was, I'm really surprised that the people behind this document, small number of people, lobbyists and some financiers, are planning to introduce this with the least scrutiny possible. They want it to be handed to the right people in the right positions. It then be proposed as policy in Whitehall and then placed within legislation. And it's all been pre-written before it started. And Kirkup remarks, which I found extraordinary, he remarks that, wow, this is weird that the world works like this. Now, I'm really surprised that someone who works at the Spectator, who was a political editor at one of the big newspapers, sees that as surprising, because I've been working in this world for 7 years, and the majority of the culture-changing legislation, regulation that I've seen come through has been done in exactly that way. A small handful of people who has already written the kind of legislation and regulation they want, handing it over to key people within government and having that change kind of pushed through. That's my practical experience, Gavin. That is how a lot of this work, not all of it, but a lot of the really key cultural changing legislation I've seen happen in that way. And we can talk about RSE, but we can also talk about, look at the latest prohibition on pro-life people being able to stand anywhere near an abortion facility. That was a small group of advocates from one organization working with about four MPs, frankly, and they managed to change public order legislation in a really radical way. So we're seeing this all the time now.
I was fatuously boasting before we came on air that I didn't need any lessons in not giving our opponents an opportunity to sue us for libel, because I'd once done a law degree and thought I was on top of it. And you remind me of walking into the English legal system lectures when I was at age 19 in order to be taught how the system worked, because I thought I knew how it worked too, but I clearly don't know either. I'm glad Kirkup doesn't know, sort of. But look, if what you have described is what happens, there are two explanations for it. One is the system is either broken or not very well adjusted and allows it to happen, but which might or might not be the case. But the other is that there are interest groups who've discovered that the system works like that and have simply set out to use time, money, and expertise to make it work on their behalf. Which of those two is true? And if they're both true, in what kind of way?
Yeah, great question. I think it's a little bit of both. One of the things that did surprise me walking into this world is, you know, you read your constitutional law or history and Parliament is sovereign, right? And you realize very quickly that actually, despite the constitutional settlement that we have and despite the executive supposedly being the executive, what is broken, in my view, this is a personal view, is that the civil service has an awful lot of power beyond what it should have constitutionally. On several occasions, I've seen members of parliament have to remind Whitehall officials in meetings that actually they're serving them in the sense that they represent the people and the mandate of the government, not the other way around.
He got rid of the Blob when he tried it.
I mean, well, exactly.
This is the same as the Blob. Is the Blob the same? I mean, I guess the civil service is part of the Blob, but the Blob is not contained by the civil service, is it?
Exactly. I think so. And regardless of what one thinks of Dominic Cummings for any other reason, I personally think he was right in saying that there needs to be some serious reform of the civil service, particularly in terms of accountability to those that are elected by the will of the people. That's our form of government. I've seen two initiatives by two different prime ministers stymied or stopped, in effect, or neutered by middle management in the civil service. So you've got sitting prime minister saying, I want this thing to happen that is legal, that's constitutionally appropriate, and I've seen it stopped or delayed for years by middle management in the civil service. And that can't be right. So I think there's an element of which things aren't working as they should. Possibly, that's my view. But I think your question hints at something that is really just true. And that is, one side has been engaging as civil society, and the other side has partly been engaging, but has mostly withdrawn on a lot of the cultural issues of our day. I think that's the bottom line here. So we can blame things like the Blob, if we want, over a gin and tonic, or we can just admit that, you know what, when it comes to it, we haven't stood up and educated ourselves effectively enough over the last 30 years.
This is a steep learning curve for me, because for much of my life, I've been very critical of my fellow Anglicans who threw themselves into the political process, because I felt that they had failed to distinguish between the politics of power and the kingdom of heaven. And it seems to me always that a proper sociological reading both of history and of the scriptures suggested that, despite my love of Graham Greene, one should be very wary indeed of assuming that the political agendas overlapped with the Christian ambition to make the kingdom of heaven as available as possible. But there's a distinction between an over-identification of political agendas and outcomes and not being involved in the political process at all. And so one of the things it seems to me that I'm having to learn now is that, first of all, I'm going to have to change the habits of a theological lifetime and say I should be involved in the political process. Otherwise, I leave it up to poor people, women like Isabel, to be arrested all by herself on the streets of Birmingham. And whilst I wasn't ever going to chain myself to a nuclear facility because I wasn't persuaded by the arguments on either side, I am persuaded about the arguments for free speech and freedom of conscience.
Yeah.
I think, therefore, I am about to become politically activist. And essentially, what I'm hoping is that through this conversation, we might persuade other Christians and especially other Catholics that this may be the moment to become politically activist. So that there are two reasons not to. One is the category error that I might have made, which whilst it might have been true for much of my lifetime, is not true anymore. And that is that politics is a dirty business and Christians should keep out of it. But the second category error, I think, is not realizing the extent to which our freedoms are being circumscribed. And that if we don't jump up the boiling pot of water soon, we're going to get cooked. What's your view about the speed with which issues of freedom of conscience and curtailments on freedom of speech have sped up in the last few years, and where are they going?
Yeah, I'm not surprised by how quickly the drive to curtail speech and prohibit speech, I'm not surprised at how fast it's been, because then it's the natural playing out of the death of the liberal moment, as we discussed in our previous podcast, that idea that we can have a free exchange of views, you know, as long as that view isn't seriously harmful or inciting violence, is the basic line that the liberal moment, you know, gave. That line has shifted. And what we have now is that we're in an era of a kind of a new set of mantras or dogmas, as we discussed in the last podcast. So the speed doesn't surprise me at all. And I think it would be naive to think that this will be slow.
I know we covered some of this before, but on the other hand, I've had time to think since then, and other people have forgotten. So I'm perfectly willing to run the risk of rehashing it, having had some thought. The thing that I guess COVID has been one of the greatest surprises in that it does two things. First of all, it illustrated the extent to which people were prepared to accept authoritarian interference in their lives. But not only did it illustrate it, but it acted as a catalyst for it. Without COVID,
yes,
you can run behind their doors and allowed the most extraordinary and improper and untested legislation to be imposed upon them. So suddenly we see that I've got to change my anthropology. So apparently the society that I'm living amongst is one in which people welcome authoritarian oversight, authoritarian interference. It's almost as if we've entered a period of politically adolescent childhood where the children, infantilized, are saying to government and scientists and others, you know best, lock us up, tell us what to do, make sure that nobody disturbs us with anything that we can't cope with. So my sense is that this is almost certainly new, brought on partly by technology, by smartphones, by MSM, by the whole internet, giving us immediate access to a wave of emotion and information that wasn't available in the past. To whatever extent people were willing to settle for authoritarian safety in the past, it's enormously exacerbated now because of the way in which technology has come upon us with AI to make it worse. The end result of that is this is new. This is I can't look back and see this happening, not even in the 1930s. And therefore, if it's new, it requires the church to take a new approach too. Is that right?
Mm. What's new, I think, is like you say, the technological means by which a authoritarian or totalitarian regime could rule. And we saw hints of how comprehensive that could be, whether it be having digital passports that control how far you move, whether it be however serious people think the 15-minute city idea might get. Apple just produced a headset that helps, that to some degree predicts what you're going to do next because of how your eyes move. That could very much be centrally linked to things as it I imagine will be in China, those kind of devices. So that's new. What's old, I think, is wanting paternalistic care from the powerful daddy. And I think it's also built into our human nature too. So I think there's this really good God-given aspect to us that plays out in different ways in periods of human history, in positive and negative contexts, right? We're made for fatherly care. Authority, even political authority, is a God-given good thing in and of itself. And there's nothing illegitimate in and of itself to, let's say, having, you know, kingship, like proper kingship, old school kingship, as most of human history has had in some kind of form. We're kind of new in the sense that you and I have kind of sat here in this post-liberal moment saying, hang on a minute, it's not normal to have authoritarian paternalism. But actually, people quite like it. Why do they like it? Well, they like it for God-given good reasons. And they like it also because there can be a sense of Stockholm syndrome and fear that socially I'm going to lose my credit, want of a better word.
Well, there's always vice and virtue. And so although we can see how authority and dependence are and so often abused, yet good feudal system works very well. I will offer you my service if you give me protection. My service is quite useful to you. Without your protection, I might be destroyed. So let's have the virtuous compact. And it's a matter of whether the compact is one of virtue or vice, I think. At the moment, it's becoming, vice is threatening us very seriously because it's moving into the area of undermining our freedom of conscience and our freedom of speech. So I've read that, particularly in America, Catholics are thinking that they should be re-involved, and there's a notion that is despised by some called integralism and proposed by others. Without going into that, what should we be doing as a Catholic community? We are, after all, I'm pleased to say I've joined the big team now. There are, in terms of people at Mass on a Sunday, the Catholic community, for all that people are worried about internal civil war and the faith dying out in the West, it's still quite a large community. And we also are bound together by a coherent articulation of Catholic social conscience. What should Catholics be doing, given the fact that other people have used their money and their talents to steer legislation in a way that we judge to be antipathetic, both to us and society? What should we be doing? And is it what you're doing?
Yeah, I think it is very connected to what I do professionally right now. And it's easy for me to say because I get paid to work in this way. But only in working this way have I understood that this is how culture changes. And it's not just me that's saying that. There's a really interesting book I was reading recently by James Davison Hunter. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called To Change the World. And there are elements of this book that I don't agree with, but there are big chunks that I think are really insightful. He's a professor of advanced culture and social theory, I think, in Virginia in the US. I think he's evangelical. He says exactly what I kind of opened with, which is looking through history and looking at sociological studies, the way that culture changes is more often top down than not. And it's more often driven and enabled by elites of various kinds in practice. And whilst we do want to think that, you know, a mass rising up can be the thing that changes things, if some element of the elite doesn't go with you, Hunter says, it rarely works or has any lasting impact. And so really the challenge I often give to young professionals who feel like they want to change the world, to use the title of his book, is to ask the Lord to engage in a dialogue with him and say, which sphere of elite, for want of a better word, which elite sphere, which institutional sphere am I called to impact? Because that's where top-down change is at the moment in our culture. It might be that I'm called to be a civil servant. It might be that I'm called to be an MP or a judge or a head teacher even. And I think an intentionality as Catholics about saying, you know what, if all things are equal, can I look intentionally to enter into a position where I might have real influence? That might be something like, you know, building your CV to become a special advisor in the government at some point, because those kind of positions can be incredibly impactful that a lot of people wouldn't think of even doing, right? Or wouldn't think of being impactful. So I think that intentionality, and I'm not scared of using the word elite here, I'm not speaking to the dignity or worth of each individual Catholic. I'm just saying for those that do want to change the world and do want to change culture, the elites and institutional networks are how it works. And that's Hunter's thesis that I actually agree with.
Don't you have to have gone to the right universities? Don't you have to have gone to Oxford? Don't you have to have done the right degrees? Don't you have to have the right friends and parents still?
No, not anymore. And I think that's long gone. I think there are two issues. The first is, it depends. I think it depends. I think having gone to Eton and Oxford isn't necessarily a positive now for an aspiring politician, for example. It might help you with certain jobs or certain chummy networks, right? Because that's the way the world has always worked and always will to some degree, let's be honest. But people trust people they know and they trust their friends. And one of the things I used to say as a teacher to children doing their GCSEs, and they thought, gosh, getting a B at GCSE ends my career, instead of getting an A. And I'd say, no, actually, what's going to dictate your career far more is the people like you and trust you and think you're competent. And that's usually done by working alongside them and building a network of people that say, that guy's all right, I like him. And that's especially true in the political sphere. So I think just engaging, right, getting involved in a party that you can stomach and actually engaging is going to be far more important than your university background, actually. Like, are you doing the political thing? Are you rubbing shoulders and doing favors? That's going to be far more important than going to the right university.
Yeah. Do people like you is also about integrity, because presumably,
yeah,
this is personal chemistry, right? But can they trust you? Have we got to the point where in the past there would have been difficulty because some Catholics might have been on the left, some on the right, and so we had at least a political spectrum, but we don't appear to have a political spectrum. I don't mean to declare my own politics too obviously, but the best that can be said about the Conservatives is that they're in the centre somewhere, and that Labour is the left of them. There is no sensible right that, at least not in our country. Interesting in the way in which it's coming up in other parts of Europe with Meloni in Italy and in Hungary and perhaps Poland. But then again, their roots are Catholic. So two questions. One is, if we're no longer divided by the old political left and right, are we about to be divided by authoritarian and libertarian, or authority and conscience? Has that happened? Is it happening? Should we make it happen? And the other thing is, if the only people not succumbing to leftish authoritarianism, because that's what I think woke culture is, if the only people are people with a Catholic culture, should we be learning something from what's happening in Italy and Hungary and Poland?
Yeah, our context is tricky, isn't it, to bring about a scenario where the kind of policies that, the good policies, again, I know Hungarian, you know, government's controversial for some, for all sorts of reasons, but I think we can all point to certain policies that we think are good from a Catholic perspective, like the fact that they're making it a lot easier to have children. We know when women talk about the reason they have an abortion in the UK, the vast majority talk about economic reasons, right? And so Hungary have responded to that in a really positive way, as one way of being pro-life, low taxation for families, taxing the family rather than the individual. All of these things are really good. There's nothing to stop Catholics in this country proposing this kind of policy change in a really coherent way.
Isn't it the family versus the state? I mean, you quite rightly perfectly entitled to say some people think that the Hungarians are too far right on the spectrum. But I've given up being worried about that, because the left always say anyone who disagrees with us is a fascist and you must be far right, so we're not going to pay any attention to you. And I mean, it's really, really tedious to hear people say, people who believe in the conscience of the family, described as German nationalists. I mean, isn't the case. But so isn't it easier, and would it be truer to say that the real fight today, or one of the ways of expressing the real fight, is to say it's the state versus the family. It's the fertile family versus the state that isn't concerned about people having children, but wants to solve things by mass migration and the dilution of national identities. Isn't that the political spectrum that we're really on, rather than employees and labor rights and the proletariat and the landed gentry? That's not where we are.
Yeah, and I think that the sands haven't sifted into clear new categories yet. And I think that's part of the problem for Catholics who want to be a united creative minority trying to push, you know, the political landscape in this country in a certain direction, for example. So I agree with you, like left and right as concepts is mostly dead in practice. I mean, what is it that defines you being right wing now? There's a massive crisis of identity in the Conservative Party, and there's a big fight internally, right? The Boris faction versus the Rishi faction versus the Truss faction. And, you know, there isn't a real sense of what it is to be conservative anymore, because, as you say, you know, arguably we've accepted socialism in the broader sense of the word. Like, that's the center ground now. And so it's really interesting to see in Catholic, you know, intellectual discussion in and around Westminster, like, what does that mean for us? And I think there's all sorts of discussion around, yeah, if we're not left and right, then maybe it's statism versus subsidiary kind of, you know, localism, for example. Maybe it's statism versus localism. And at the heart of localism, obviously, is families. So family, village, town, region, that sense of subsidiary reality, right, that we've lost in our political order. I think a lot of people recognize that that's the problem. Now, some Catholics would say, you know what, the state's the issue, so let's be as libertarian as we can in what we push for. And you have other Catholics that are vehemently opposed to that and would say, no, my view is more in the Venn diagram of integralism that you referenced. No, let's use that state power, let's accept it, and let's even enhance it, because we want to enable a kind of social change in policy that we prefer, because there is no neutral ground in politics. And so you've got this really interesting discussion going on, I think, within Catholic circles at the moment that I've been privy to, about what do we do? What is the new alignment? And where do we sit within it? And what should we advocate for? Regardless of what your view is on either of those discussions, I think family first is something we can all unite behind, that and family-friendly policy is something we can all unite behind.
Right. So I take your point. It's very well made that the sands are still shifting. We can't see what they are. We know that left and right is passé, should never have been in the first place, perhaps. Anyway, not remotely helpful. But shouldn't Catholics have been uniting together already in order to withstand the assault on abortion and seeing euthanasia coming and knowing perfectly well, because, you know, we're theologically alert, we know how human beings screw up an excess of power and the danger of treating people, desacralizing the human person. So that's, it's obvious to all Catholics that euthanasia will be mishandled. Why aren't Catholics already fully engaged in a process that changes, enlarges the climate of thinking on abortion? Because the problem with abortion is it's been presented from only one side, whereas it ought at least to have two sides. Whatever you decide, both sides ought to be represented, and they're not. And euthanasia is becoming really problematic. I mean, is it just, again, culturally, Catholics have not been much involved in politics in England, partly because there's been a sense of innate marginalization for all kinds of historical reasons. One of the things that converts to Catholicism want to do is to take the sense that they always had, that they at least were part of society, and being a Catholic shouldn't stop us, and say to the rest of the Catholic community, you may have felt marginalized because of association with immigrant status or not being part of the establishment, but that needs to change because the times are too dangerous.
I get that. And what you're saying about, I think, abortion is a really interesting example, right? Look at your average Catholic who would say, I believe what the creed says, I believe what the church teaches. What do we see from Catholics that really do believe those things? I think we see extraordinary engagement now. I think it's been a big shift in the last 15 years. I think my generation and down, those that do believe, genuinely believe what the church teaches and have a personal relationship with the Lord, are incredibly heavily engaged. And you see that reflected, for example, the fact that the pro-life movement in this country is largely funded by Catholics. And it's several million pounds a year, like several, that are given. Not every Catholic can be engaged in politics, right? And that's where the gap is that you mentioned in your question. I think there's a general problem with getting involved in the political life, as in being an MP, especially, or being a special advisor, for example, in government, for those that are conservative in general, right? Because you're more likely to say, you know what, I'm going to have a family. That's the heart of human living. I'm going to have a family, and I'm going to recognize that my primary duty is to my family, and I'm going to give wholeheartedly to them, and I'm going to serve the community primarily through giving to my family well and educating them well. And then with what time I have spare will be for other things. That makes it far less likely that you can take a job as a journalist now. Why? Because you're not paid enough to raise a family as a journalist now. It makes it far less likely you're going to be a member of parliament, because being a member of parliament involves ludicrous hours of work, like crazy anti-family conditions. And it's a toxic environment, frankly, culturally. It's a very difficult environment to be in Westminster if you have values of integrity and you don't like, you know, Machiavellian dealings with others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in general, there's a difficulty for conservatives to get involved. And then obviously that's really acute for Catholics. And so the gap isn't between, is the engaged Catholic engaging in the way that they can? I think the issue is it difficult for an engaged Catholic to be involved in the key roles that form and shape culture, whether it be an MP, whether it be a newspaper editor, whether it be various other roles within government and policy making? It can be quite tricky, actually. And I think that's where the biggest gap is. And I think that takes a really intentional conversation with the Lord, and it takes a maybe intentional, you know, God-anointed sacrificial act by your family as a whole. But I think you need a spouse's real active consent for that kind of life. You know, many MPs will speak to that.
And I don't want to take you into an area that may be too personal, but nonetheless, you and I have talked briefly about this in the future, so you might be willing to. The moment you lift up one stone, you find another stone underneath it, or the moment you climb one hill, there's another one behind it. So one of the things you talked about requires less dependence on the nuclear family and more on the extended family. And some of the conversations I've been part of are Catholics coming together to form aspects of community that become a form of ecclesial extended family. And that begins to take some of the pressure off one husband and one wife raising on one or one and a half salaries. I first came across this in France, where there's a sense that Catholics are trying to move into medium-sized towns in fairly large numbers, so that at least there's some level of mutual protection. You know, there will be Catholic lawyers, Catholic teachers, Catholic dentists, Catholic car mechanics. You can find people that you can trust to help your community. And then clearly that will allow people to raise children, not being dependent on any one or one of our parents. Is this a concomitant of what we're talking about? In other words, it's not just enough to try and get involved in politics, but actually we have to rethink ecclesial community, ecclesial living, in order to allow people not to be victims of capitalism.
Yeah, 100%. And we're seeing that movement in this country too, which is really heartening. I think the church institution was going to take some time to catch up. It may take 20, 30 years to catch up with, I think, what the laity are doing in response to the culture that they find themselves in, or they want for their children. I think that's the key motivator. But this connects to what our broader conversation about culture, right? So if it's correct that most cultural change is top-down and the Overton window of acceptable speech and opinion tends to be driven by the mainstream media, you know, the politicians, the newspaper editors, etc. That being true, there's still an awful lot of wiggle room for controlling and affecting and shaping the Overton window or the cultural bubble in which each of us lives at various levels, right? So that could be our workplace, that could be our town, and that can be our family and our friends too. And I think one of the things that's happened to a lot of Christians and Catholics over the last 20 years is we have this sense that, you know, culture just kind of sweeps over us and cultural change will happen and we can't shape it or resist it or be creative within it. And one of the main things I'd like to say to people today is that just isn't true. That's a kind of, I think that's a lie of the evil one, to have us submit to a culture of death and a culture of despair that we're living in right now. And the fact is that particularly in small groups, whether it be within the town in the way that you're speaking to, whether it be within the workplace or whether it be even within the family home, frankly, you draw the windows of acceptable speech and opinion around yourself more often than not. So if in the workplace I never speak to the fact that I pray, it's going to be extreme that someone says that they pray once a year, if they kind of admit that, you know, in a really kind of embarrassed way. If, however, there are four of us in the break room on a regular basis talking about going to Mass on a Sunday, it normalizes that prayer is a real thing that people do, right? So that's just one simple example of how we have far more control over the cultural boundaries in which we operate than we'd like to think. And, you know, if we are able to have conviction and then act upon it and speak with charity of things we believe or what we do as Christians, that helps our brother or sister next to us that might not be quite as certain as us to have that space and that freedom to be openly Christian. And so I think at every level below the national, of which we've been speaking of, that is key for top-down cultural change, we still have an awful lot of power to control the culture and shape the culture in which we live. And it's really important we don't ignore that, because I think there's a kind of defeatism within Christian circles that can be an excuse for laziness. But I think it's a result of not realizing this, thinking culture just happens to us. And that creates a kind of inactivity, a kind of passivity. And it also creates a kind of martyr mentality where it's like, you know what, I'm looking to be a martyr, which isn't what the gospel calls us to do and the great witnesses of the Bible and Christian history call us to do. It calls us to stand, know what our lines are and be resolute and have faithful courage when that persecution comes, but not to be looking for it. And I think the antidote to that kind of defeatism is understanding that we can shape the culture. We can shape it nationally through elite engagement, and we can shape it locally by clubbing together, whether it be in the town or the workplace or the family.
Let me be difficult for the moment and say that whilst I agree with everything you said, of course, the problem seems to be also exacerbated by a secularization of Catholicism. So if we were to go to education, which would be, if one would say, well, where are the places that we can make some difference? The way we have our children educated is obviously one place. And yet, in terms of the whole woke utopian engagement that the new sexuality has imposed, Catholic education seems to have swallowed wholesale. We've yet to see the Catholic Education Service do anything but apologize for the hurt feelings of LGBTQ plus people when there's a crisis. The bishops are holding their silence. The CES is has yet to show any obvious Catholic muscle. What can other Catholics do? If we can't share a clear, coherent Catholic anthropology when it comes to education and sexuality above all, aren't we in some kind of serious trouble?
So I think the question is, can we still within institutions like schools? And I think the answer is just about yes. I think the new relationships and sex education and guidance regulations make it very, very tricky. And I think increasingly as a church, we're going to have to face the question of, are we going to accept secular inspection regimes downgrading us for the sake of being able to teach the anthropology of the church, or to not say certain things as we legally can do right now? And so I think the big divide really for educational institutions right now is the difference between what the law enables, what the law allows you, and in fact encourages you to do as a Catholic institution, and what the inspection regime, which is usually Ofsted, sometimes ISI, is looking for you to do culturally as their view about what good cultural formation for young people is. What I'm saying is there is the space to do it still. There is the space. If I'm a good head teacher, I can do that well. The problem with RSE is once you introduce, for example, LGBT into your curriculum, the requirement is that you embed it throughout the curriculum. You can't just say, as you could have said 3 years ago, let's deal with same-sex marriage, the fact that it's legal, the fact that everyone's worthy of respect, regardless of their sexual orientation, etc. You could deal with that really well, actually, the Catholic school a few years ago, in a few lessons by which you present the Catholic view in its fulsomeness, and then you say, legally, this is the case, this is the law of this country, and we're called to respect everyone. The whole point about the new RSE regime is it's designed to stop you being able to do that. It's designed to force a school and an institution into expressing the normativity of the LGBT, of LGBT issues, lifestyles, actions, constantly. Because the people that wrote the regulations or had a massive impact in, and here's a great example. We know particular organizations that I won't name had a massive impact on the final wording of the RSE regulations. And they know what changes culture. And they know that if a school can say, well, this is the law, this is same-sex marriage under the law, the Catholic view is different, that isn't going to change the culture of these students. But they do know that you have to embed it throughout the curriculum and express it in various ways. And then the inspection regime is going to encourage that for a top grade. They know that's how culture changes, and that's exactly what we have. So there's just enough space. What I'm saying is there is just enough space for schools to do it well and do it positively. I think having been a practitioner myself, I think schools are under-resourced with the tools and the confidence that they need to do it well. Tough moment in that sense.
And you're well, very well placed, because one of the things you do professionally is to defend both the Catholic teachers who take a stand for the faith and to hold the culture to account for doing it within the constraints of what the law is, rather than overspilling them as they so often do with a degree of cultural impetus. So Rancor, thank you so much. This has been really enormously helpful. I think the last thing is, don't we need a rallying cry? I'm not going to blame the bishops. That's much too simple. But where do we look for a rallying cry, for a rearticulation of Catholic faith? Obviously, the Catholic Herald podcast. But beyond that,
yes.
where do we look for the inspiration and for the encouragement that the Catholic community needs to get re-engaged in the political process in order to defend the faith?
I remember inviting Lord Alton to speak, to give a public lecture in Glasgow when I was living up there. And he got, in the Q&A after his excellent remarks, as he always gives, he was asked, why are there so many terrible people in politics and why don't we see a real articulation of Catholicism in politics, etc. And Lord Alton turns to the person and says, well, you know, that's the whole point of me being here. It's to encourage you to say, I think you can do it better. There are people in this audience that can do it better. And so I think the onus is on us. I think instead of looking elsewhere and complaining, I think we have are we potentially being called to be a person of cultural impact? Is it a job change? Is it a skill set I have? Can I be part of that elite that shifts things? Can I be a key part of an institution that shifts culture? Can I be more intentional in getting involved in that way? Because I do think we're seeing like a mini renaissance of that cultural minority, that creative minority of Catholics in public life, in areas like journalism, for example, right? I think there are an awful lot of Catholics or people converting to Catholicism that are saying the most interesting things culturally right now. And I think that's starting to be recognized beyond Catholic circles too. So I'm encouraged by that. But I think the bottom line is there are plenty of people, there are enough Catholics with the skill set and the drive to completely change the culture of this country in 50 years. So, you know, the question is, why haven't you started?
Ryan Christopher, thank you for your encouragement. Thank you for your optimism. and thank you too for your expertise. It's been great talking to you. Thank you.